From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. My guests this week are documentary filmmakers Joan Kramer and David Healy. They are the award-winning creators of many outstanding documentaries that tell the stories of some of our greatest stars: Fred Astaire, Katharine Hepburn, Humphrey Bogart, Spencer Tracy, Sonny Tufts. Oh, wait, not Sonny Tufts. But in any case, Joan Kramer and David Healy have the magic touch for dealing with legendary stars. They have written a book about their experiences called In the Company of Legends. Joan Kramer and David Healy, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, we're happy to be here, Gary.
Delighted to be here. Thank you.
I loved your book, but really what we need is a box set of your documentaries. When is that coming? Is that in the works?
We wish. Unfortunately, not all of them have rights anymore. When we started doing them, there was the idea of home video was just a glimmer in the distance. So in those early shows, we didn't get the rights for anything but broadcast. But a lot of the later shows are out in DVD, thank goodness.
Oh, that's good, because they are wonderful shows, and I remember watching them all when they were on originally, but I didn't know that you two were behind them all. You guys are, you know, behind the scenes kind of people.
Well, that's why we're behind the scenes. You're not supposed to know about it.
You know, when you say legends, and I'm basing this on the stories that I've read in your book, when you say legends, you really could also use the word pains in the ass. Am I right?
Sometimes a legend's allowed to be a pain in the ass.
I think they think they're allowed to be because they've been told that they're legends all their lives.
Most of them actually behave pretty well. I think the pains in the ass stories are few and far between. But yes, of course, there are hitches, there are problems. I think what people might gather from reading the book is that what looks very smooth and easy on the screen is often very tumultuous behind the screen to make it look that way.
You know, I haven't met many of these. I did once have an opportunity to meet Fred Astaire, and I found him to be an absolutely marvelous and sweet, unassuming fellow.
We were rather concerned about meeting Fred Astaire because when we met him, it was to show him a rough cut of the show we'd done about him, which was not something either of us was looking forward to. We'd been warned in particular by Hermes Pan, who'd worked with him all those years as his main choreographer, partnering choreographer, because Astaire did a lot of his own choreography, of course, that Astaire could be very difficult. He was very picky and wanted things to be perfect, and if he didn't like something, you would hear it in no uncertain terms. So showing him a show about himself was something that we were not looking forward to at all. But it was part of the deal he and his agent made with us to give us his permission to do the show. Oh, and by the way, Mr. Astaire would like to look at a rough cut.
Now, you guys sort of have a policy about showing programs that haven't been on the air yet to the people involved. What kinds of things could a star say that would be hell for you if they watched the program in advance?
Oh, well, they could say, I didn't like the way my hair looked. Could we do it again? I didn't think my makeup was right. Can we do it again? I should have worn a different shirt, a different jacket. I mean, you know, you can wind up with problems you never anticipated.
This was something we could not avoid. What had happened is that we'd pressed ahead with the idea of making a show about Astaire, not knowing that he could stop us. Because, in fact, his lawyer in the 30s was very, very clever and inserted a clause into his contracts giving him control over his clips. So getting his permission was, in the end, more than important. It was vital. And when the agent said, oh, and by the way, Mr. Astaire would like to see a rough cut before you put the show to bed, we basically had no choice.
But Astaire, he didn't have a problem.
Well, no, we lucked out. What we realized later was that he hadn't seen many of his films in a long time. He didn't watch himself on television, so he was looking at himself dancing, and he was enjoying the experience. He was tapping his feet and humming along with the music. When we saw that happening, we heaved a big sigh of relief because we positioned ourselves behind him so that we could see his reaction to the screaming, without having to turn around and look at him. So it was when that happened, when he was watching the very first number, which was putting on his top hat, we realized that maybe things weren't going to be as bad as we'd anticipated.
And it, what he saw, by the way, was a really rough cut. In 1980, we were not in the digital world of editing. And therefore, I mean, it was really terrible quality of the clips. We were using work tapes, work films, before we inserted the real good, the good quality material. We left black spaces where still photographs would be. And the narrator of those shows wound up to be Joanne Woodward, but for this rough cut, David did the scratch track of narration. There was no music.
Very appropriate. It was very, very rough.
Really rough.
Yeah. But mostly Fred was taken with his own dancing, so that's all that it needed to worry about.
Not just his own dancing. He also was commenting on other people as well. Look how much better I'm dancing with her, he said, when he saw himself with Rita Hayworth.
Ah. Well, you know, when you watch them in that scene where Rita is in the chorus line and she's wearing those little white shorts, and he takes her out and does that little dance routine, that's, I think, the only scene in the history of Fred Astaire that you don't even glance at Fred Astaire.
Rita was very special, no doubt. Knockout.
Yeah, well, she was. Lovely. She was very lovely. And I guess those white shorts have stuck with me over these years.
You and thousands, millions of other people. She was, after all, the love goddess.
That's right. Orson Welles literally saw her picture on Life magazine and said, I'm going to marry that girl, and then proceeded to do that.
And then he did, yes. He had a way of getting what he wanted. Not always, but quite often.
Did you ever encounter Welles in your travels?
I did when I worked for the Dick Cavett show. He was on for 90 minutes, so I briefly met him.
Right.
But not in our shows together, David's and my shows together.
Well, Joan Kramer, Dick Cavett essentially gave you your start in show business?
Yes. I mean, Dick was my first job in television. And I, to this day, say it was the best job in television and the best training for what I eventually wound up doing when I worked with David. But, you know, doing a live 90-minute to tape, we never edited that show. We taped at 6 o'clock at night until 7:30, and it went on as it was taped at 11:30 with no edits, no matter what happened, and people walked off. And the only time they ever stopped tape was when a man died in the middle of a taping.
A lot of the people that you later encountered, the two of you in your documentaries, were people who were solo guests on Dick Cavett's show when he would devote a whole show. Certainly he did one with Fred Astaire.
He did two with Fred Astaire, actually.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because Fred Astaire was not great on talk shows.
No, he was too shy, or...
Yeah.
He was too shy. Yes, he wasn't very good about talking. I mean, it was a great coup to get Astaire on a show, but he was not. We went through those two entire shows trying to find some snippets of him saying something really insightful, and it was very hard.
Hmm. Yeah.
You know, that's a testament to Dick, because filling 90 minutes with Fred Astaire, basically giving very, very short. Not necessarily. I mean, they were intelligent, but he wasn't a talker.
Not like Welles or somebody, certainly.
No. Welles was great.
And Bette Davis, who you later encountered.
Mm-hmm. She did 90 minutes with him. He asked her a question about how she was able to deal with the gossip columnists in the heyday of Hollywood. And she said, you mean Luella Parsons and Hedda Hopper? And he said, yes, that, you know, for example, yes. And she said, well, you know, I'm a Connecticut Yankee, and I never had a problem, excuse me, I never had a problem saying to somebody who asked me a question I didn't want to deal with, I never had a problem saying I'd rather not discuss that. She said, there are people that believe that just because they're asked a question, they have to answer it. I always knew that I didn't have to answer it. And so Dick said, Dick told us later, I knew a straight line when I heard it. And so he said to her, well, so far, I think we've kept this on a rather high level, don't you? And she said, yes, I wouldn't expect you to ask me something that I didn't want to discuss, but if you did, I could do the same thing. I don't wish to discuss it. And he said, Betty, when did you lose your virginity? At which point, Betty Davis burst into laughter, and she said to him, I'll tell you. At which point, he almost fell off the chair.
Well, we're talking with Joan Kramer and David Healy, and they have just written this book called In the Company of Legends. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Now, David Healy, how did you get started in show business?
Oh, very roundabout way. I had a degree in physics, of all things, and I got a job at the BBC in the engineering department and managed to climb that ladder, get over the wall between engineering and production, and became a staff director at the BBC. Moved to New York, got a job at WNET, the public television station here, and eventually, from just a low beginning, as it were, climbed the ladder once more and started producing shows there. But my love has always been the arts, even though my education is in the sciences. So Joan and I met when we were doing a local art series on WNET called Skyline. And, of course, the local art series in New York City gives you a huge palette to deal with. And we did a number of shows together, and out of a show we did with Rudolf Nureyev came the idea of doing a program about Fred Astaire.
And your partnership was
born. Shorthand version.
Uh-huh. Well, when you were working, so when you came here and started working in American television, you almost exclusively worked either for PBS or NET as it was known then, or you've done shows for other cable networks. And would you say that's more closely aligned with working at the BBC than if you'd come to do a show, say, at NBC or CBS?
Probably, yes. So, I mean, it goes without saying that the closest thing to the BBC here is public television, although there's actually a huge difference. What I always say about the BBC, the way it differs from commercial broadcasters is it exists for one purpose. It exists to make programs, whereas commercial television exists to make money. And so you have a totally different philosophy that goes into the making of programs. What you hope happens in public television also is they exist to make programs, and so that's their intent, and they put everything they have into making those programs as good as possible, even though sometimes the resources are very scant and it's very tricky going. Everybody knows the story about public television in the United States. But public television was very good to me. I think it was very good to us, and it certainly got us moving on these very high-profile programs about the Hollywood stars from that golden era. We were very lucky that we happened to do it at that time.
And, of course, those documentaries that you guys have made on all the stars have been the cornerstone of Pledge Breaks for the last 30 years.
Well,
yes, my family always say, please, are they going to air during pledge weeks? Well, you know, there was a special fund at PBS set aside to finance programs specifically made for those pledge weeks.
And
more high-profile names, et cetera, et cetera, in the programming. And therefore, you know, we, you know, when in public television, when you're offered money, you don't turn it down.
Exactly. Sure. Of course.
You know?
Yeah.
And we were providing the big star names for them, so they gave us money to make these shows for Pledge Week.
And not only do you
know, Gary,
yes.
The original name. I'm sorry, David, were you talking?
No, it was me.
No,
you,
go
right
no,
I'm sorry. The original
let's
name
all talk at
book,
once. Oh no, sorry, Gary. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The original name for this book was a title that probably you'll laugh at, but we were determined to call it what I'm about to tell you because it's the question we were asked every time we finished a program. And the title of the book was going to be that question, so who are you going to do next?
Mm.
Now, we had that title for a long time, and suddenly late in the game our publisher said to us, you know, you might want to think about changing that title.
Who are you going to do next?
A different sort of book.
Who are you
going to do next? But, you know, we never thought of it in any context other than the one that we heard it in from one show to the next.
I think that would have been a perfectly acceptable title. Or
yes, a lot of people think it would have been, but I think the one we've got is probably better.
In the Company of Pains in the Ass. In the Company of Legends is the book, and Joan Kramer and David Healy are the authors, and we're speaking to them. You know, you guys not only got great stars to make your shows about and to interview, but you also got great stars to talk about the other great stars. Now, there's one actor, I don't think he's a great star, but he was a kind of a B actor that was in a lot of pictures. I don't know whatever happened to him. His name is Ronald Reagan. And you guys got him to talk about Jimmy Stewart. But that was kind of a roundabout. That was a good story. That's what I'm trying to
say. Well, they knew each other from Hollywood. But by the time we were getting ready to do the Jimmy Stewart show, Ronald Reagan was no longer in Hollywood. He was in Washington at the big place.
Yeah, what was he doing there? He had some minor function.
He had some big job there.
Yes.
And so, of course, getting him to appear on the show about Jimmy Stewart, we knew it was not going to be easy, but we decided we had to have a go at it. And so we wrote a letter and sent it to the White House, actually expecting to be rejected, and it was rejected, but it got as far as... What was his title, Joan?
Director of Presidential Appointments
and Scheduling.
Scheduling.
Yes, that's right. Yes, I'm afraid the name is skipping my mind, Joan.
Is Frederick J. Ryan Jr.
That's
who, by the way, now is the publisher of the Washington Post.
Huh. So this didn't hurt his career any. But go ahead, tell the story.
It didn't hurt his career.
So we got
this letter. He wrote a
letter
back to us saying, we're very sorry, but the president and Mrs. Reagan will not be able to appear on your program about the late James Stewart. And so he gave
us a great opening. In 1986, James Stewart was not the late.
No, he still had 10, 11 more years of life ahead of him, I think.
Exactly.
So that gave us a chance to go back. That mistake actually gave us the opportunity to go back and eventually get Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan on the show. We went to the White House and interviewed them.
And was that fun, going to the White House and stealing things?
Yes, it was fun, of course.
Stealing things out, let me clarify. Come on, I took paper towels that had the presidential seals stamped on them that were in the dispenser in the ladies' room.
The Secret Service are on their way.
Wash your hands and dry your hands with paper towels and throw them away. I can take a couple.
The Secret Service are on their way to your home right now.
Exactly. No, they were absolutely charming. They were just easy to talk to and fun and very warm and very friendly. It was a very good experience.
You could tell they actually relished talking about that time in their lives, which was probably a pleasant experience compared to what they were going through in Washington.
It's kind of too bad that nobody ever did a profile on Ronald Reagan at that time, you know, just talking about his movie career.
Yeah,
he loved
good,
talking
actually.
About his... I mean, yeah. You know, he loved talking about Hollywood, as did she, and they loved... even after the camera stopped, because we were told we'd have 20 minutes, and we thought, oh my gosh, we've got a long list of questions, we'll never make it. So David and I were trying to figure out what to cut out in from our questions, and it turned out that even after the camera stopped rolling, they kept talking, and the woman in charge had other things for them to do that afternoon. I think she was freaking out a bit, because I wasn't going to tell the president, we have to go now.
Right.
You know?
Well, I guess the astrologer said it was a good day to talk to you guys.
Gary, I like your style.
Oh, thank you. One of my favorites is Johnny Carson, and you guys had a great encounter with him.
We had a hard time basically hooking Jimmy Stewart and getting him to finally say yes and not back out again on the show we were doing about him. And what would have happened is we hadn't given much thought to who would host the show. Normally we'd have a long list of people and we'd be considering that way in advance of everything else. But we were actually we were in L.A. on our way to a meeting with MGM, who was co-producing the show with us. And I said to Joan, we haven't thought about who's going to host this show yet. We better come up with some ideas for this meeting. They're going to say who's going to be your host. And out of nowhere, I said, why don't we, you know, Johnny Carson's a pretty good idea because the two of them were always terrific on The Tonight Show. Maybe we should suggest that. So when we got to the meeting, we suggested Johnny Carson, and they said, yes, great, of course. Then we had to get him.
Without a clue, we bring up a name that they thought was fabulous, and then we had to figure out what to do next.
Carson wasn't known for doing TV other than The Tonight Show.
No, he knew what he did well in The Tonight Show, and he didn't want to do other things. He did the Oscars occasionally, of course, and he was very good at that, but, mm-hmm. but he was at home on The Tonight Show, and he didn't really want to veer away from that. But, Joan, tell Gary how we got him.
Well, we left that meeting, and I called up Jimmy Stewart's press agent, who by then had become a friend, a man named John Strauss. And I said, John, do you have any idea how to reach Johnny Carson? Because I knew instinctively, you can't write a letter to Johnny Carson at The Tonight Show. It's like writing to the White House. You know, it will go through 17 layers before it even gets read.
It probably will not get to him in the end.
So John Strauss said, yes, I know a man named David Tebbutt. David Tebbutt was a talent executive at NBC for many, many years and was the man responsible in large part for getting Johnny Carson to become the host of The Tonight Show after Jack Parr left. And so I called David Tebbutt, and David Tebbutt said, send me a letter, and I'll hand it to Johnny. And 3 days later, he called and said, Johnny asked me to give you his home number, but please don't tell him what I'm about to tell you. And he said, he's going to do this for you, but he wants to tell you himself. Well, the mere fact that he said he's going to give us Johnny's number was a pretty good clue. But I called Johnny, and he said, I'll be happy to do this show with you if you're sure it'll be okay with Jim. And I said, okay, try ecstatic. And he said, okay. And I must say, it took 3 days. I mean, it literally took one day of our writing a letter. Then it was in David Tebbutt's court, so to speak.
It's very
unusual. So then Johnny said, come out to California and we'll talk.
Like that so quickly and so easily. So there had to be a hitch, and there was.
Yes. When you got there, what happened?
David?
Oh, yes. He said, come to my house, and we'll talk about it. So we went to his beautiful new home at Point Doom in California, and he met us at the door. There was nobody else, just came to the door, met us, and he showed us around the house. He was very proud of it. I was proud of the tennis courts he was building just across the street because he was an avid tennis player and tennis fan. And then he said, let's go down to the den. So he took us downstairs to his den, past, by the way, a great statue of Stan Laurel, somebody who he admired a great deal. And he said, sit down. And we sat down. And he said, you know, I've been thinking about this. I don't think I'm the right person to host your show.
Oh, no.
Bombshell. Bombshell. He said, you just did a show about Spencer Tracy that Katharine Hepburn hosted, and that made a lot of sense. They knew each other. They worked together. I know Jim, but I've never worked with him. I don't call him appearing on The Tonight Show working with him. I think you need somebody who has experience working with him on film. I think you should have Cary Grant host the show. He said, I know Cary. I'll give him a call.
Now, Gary, if you know anything about Cary Grant, which you probably do.
Yeah.
If Johnny Carson never did anything outside of The Tonight Show except occasionally the Oscars, Cary Grant never appeared on television, period. Period.
Yeah, right.
So David and I left that house, left Johnny's house, really depressed. On the one hand, we thought, number one, Cary Grant's never going to do this. And even if he did, the people watching the show would be so fascinated that Cary Grant agreed to appear on television that they'd be watching more interested in the host than the subject of the show, Jimmy.
Yeah.
And if Cary Grant said no, which was most likely, then we were worried that Johnny was going to run around town calling up every person that he could think of to replace himself with, which could take months. Well,
fast forward to the next morning, Joan wakes up.
I woke up, the phone rang in the hotel, and it was Johnny. And he said to me, well, I called Carrie, and the housekeeper told me that he's on tour doing that one-man show he does about his life and career. He won't come on the on television to do it, but he does it in colleges. And he won't be back for several weeks. So, and with perfect timing pause, I guess you're stuck with me.
The guy you wanted all along.
Yes.
And I mean, first of all, here I was stunned again. And I said to him, finally, when I regained my composure, I said to him, Johnny, you don't have any idea how happy I am to be so stuck. Well, fast forward to after that meeting when he said, you're stuck with me. It was not long after, we're back at home in New York, and it was Thanksgiving, and a long weekend, and on Sunday, after Thanksgiving that year, I was watching television, and David was watching television, and there was a news flash in the middle of programming on television, and the news flash said, Cary Grant dead in Davenport, Iowa. He was on his way to one of those speaking engagements there. And the next morning, Johnny called me. And I said, oh, Johnny, you beat me to it. You see, he called me at 10 o'clock in the morning. I didn't want to call him at what was 7 a.m. in L.A. I didn't know how early he gets up. But he called me at 10 o'clock, and I said, Johnny, I'm so sorry. I know I spoke to Cary Grant once or twice, but I didn't know him. I know you were friends. I'm so sad. I mean, the whole world is sad. And he said, Joan, I want to tell you what I wanted to say when you just answered the phone. I said, okay. And he said, I wanted to say, I asked Cary Grant to host your show, and he dropped dead. And I said to him, Johnny, that's not funny. And he said, yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
We had read a lot about him, and we knew we could have a really rough time with Johnny Carson. We didn't have any problems at all with him. He was just
not only
wonderful.
That, but the man that was known to be cold and aloof, we never saw cold and aloof.
That's wonderful.
And we not only did the show with him, but we stayed in touch, and we talked on the phone, and we went to a taping of The Tonight Show, and he invited us back to talk to him. We never found Johnny Carson cold and or aloof, ever.
Well, I've made Joan Kramer and David Healy tell you some of my favorite stories, but this book is full of them. It's a great book. It's called In the Company of Legends, and the authors are my guests, Joan Kramer and David Healy. I want to thank you both for being my guest on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, we've
Thank
enjoyed
you.
It very
it was
much.
A pleasure.
It was a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guests, Joan Kramer and David Healy. Their new book is called In the Company of Legends. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.